After Things is brought to you by patreon.com/weirdthings. Thank you for supporting this show.
Hello and welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Mean, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello.
Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hello.
So I want to start with a kind of an obscure recommendation that I don't know if you guys heard about, but I've been involved in the field of magic for years. And one of the people I look up to is a guy named Teller. Mm-hmm. And recently on Twitter, he recommended a podcast, which kind of goes into like hoaxes and cons and things like this. And I think it sounded kind of similar to something you guys are working on. And I think the fact that a high-level guy like Teller's recommending it, it's kind of cool.
Well,
and
when you say recommending, I mean, was it like a tepid reference to it, or
no? He really liked this thing. I don't know about your thing, mm-hmm. but he really liked this thing. He says,
"I think we can read it." We can read it right now here, Bryce. If you can put it back up, my ingenious friend Schwood's podcast is called.
Wow, it's weird. It's like almost like Brushwood, but yeah. It's not the same.
It's called World's Greatest Con.
Oh.
It's funny.
Oh,
they're using your name. Mm-hmm. They're using your name.
Actually, here, let me read the rest of this, and then I'm going to put a pin in somebody the New York Times listens to the podcast. It's funny, fiery, charming, and sometimes horrifying take on history, trickery, and personal stories. Second season starts tonight, but it's fine. But if you haven't heard the first, it starts here, and then he links to the website.
Wow.
Just an amazing cosign by Teller.
It was deeply, deeply flattering.
Yeah.
And I think most people know that he's not one to liberally just, you know, lavish praise on things that he doesn't really enjoy.
I don't know if I should say the magician's name or if this is public, but his prayer.
Public? Yeah, he said it. Matt Donnelly has said many times on Penn Sunday School that his prayer, or is it Piff's? No, I think
it is Piff. It's Piff's prayer. Yeah, Piff, the magic dragon.
He says, "May I never know what Teller truly thinks of my act."
And that's somebody who they work with all the time. Like, who is like thought of as a protege to Penn and Teller. But that is obviously Teller is somebody that thinks very deeply, not only about magic, but also art. And it was incredibly gratifying to have him.
Whose Twitter feed is this?
The Great Knight Twitter account. Sorry.
Following Teller.
Jiminy Bimini.
Jiminy Bimini.
It is now, as far as anybody who's watching and doesn't have access to Twitter analytics.
Hey, real quick pro tip for anybody who wants to support a thing. In the world of Twitter, you can't just keep retweeting the same thing over and over again. However, what you can do is retweet other people quote tweeting a thing. So, like, for example, if people were to say, "That's amazing, Teller's great, so I bet this show's great," that's a thing I could retweet. But I can't retweet your retweet of Teller's tweet.
And two things to add to that. You can click untweet and retweet your own tweet, and it will often go in front of new people if you have a large following algorithmically.
I'm hearing this for the first time. I'll give that a try.
Just telling for people who maybe didn't know that, you can untweet and retweet. Well,
thank you. This is, I'm excited.
I don't understand how conspicuous we're supposed to be right now.
Yeah. Second thing is if you like a thing, you can retweet the thing a person said, but then retweet with your own quote. Because then that gives them something that they can retweet.
There's a virtuous cycle there.
If you liked it, like, "Oh, I love the show. This was great. This episode was really good." That's even more helpful than a retweet in many cases. Because now, I can retweet what you said. And so if you want to create something, people are like,
Hypothetically, I may have been waiting a few hours to quote tweet Teller and say, "For those of you who don't know, season one was about Operation Mincemeat and season two was about game shows."
Unfortunately, season three is about Penn and Teller fool us in hell.
Oh, no. It's the ultimate takedown, the ultimate betrayal. I forged a friendship with Teller over 25 years only to betray him.
This is
the world's greatest con.
I could name a couple magicians that you could have give you
So with season two wrapped up today, or that you've got a bonus episode to put out still, how did it go?
How did the season go?
Yeah.
I'm very happy with it. I mean,
do you feel like that
from a production point of view? You just listen to this stuff so much. Like
you hear it a lot.
You're just kind of dealing with it. And then you're dealing with minutia on minutia on minutia. And then it's notes on notes on notes. And you're
Brian's
getting it.
Brian's grading voice.
All right. This might be getting too real right now, but we did a publicity tour of some other podcasts. And I figured out real quick that the way to promote it is to basically give a miniature one-man show of highlights of it. And, and Justin points out, like, wow, man, you sure are polished, nailing every word. Pity you couldn't have done that during production.
Oh, my God. What a tyrant, Brian.
Just God.
If you came back for season two to work with this guy, James Cameron right now is going, geez, that dude's rough.
I mean, but of course, the reason is because when I'm doing it, for a podcast, I'm just basically singing an album I've listened to 100 times, and so I don't have to think about what I'm saying.
And not under the cruel rape of Justin Roger. You don't need it, too.
Exactly. So just... like Mephisto perched over his shoulder, like, read the script.
It really was funny though.
It was very. So there's just so much audio. There's just nothing like getting an hour and a half to 2 hour block of audio that you know is going to edit down to like 30 minutes. Yep.
So one thing that you guys talked about for season one was. Your writing style, which is very iterative, right? You're constantly writing and rewriting and updating and updating and updating. How do you feel like that process went for season two? Do you feel like that process was shorter due to more confidence? Do you feel like it was longer due to knowing better how to work that system?
Also, we have to add, there was one episode last season that we worked with Merrill Barr, and he wrote the episode but did not record it. I recorded it and edited it. In this season, we had Will Saddleberg come in, who is working with Dog and Pony Show, and he not only wrote the script, but also recorded and edited the two of the episodes this season. And then, like, at a certain point, I took over, like, a fully populated audition file as opposed to just having a script and having it pushed through. So, like, that was an added... a complexity, but in general, I would say I think we knew more of the DNA of what goes into an episode. We knew what was missing. We knew what needed to be there. Like, so I think it was a more confidently produced season.
All of that is true. However, there is the multiplier effect of season one. We told one story over 4 30 to 40 minute chapters. This time we did 5 stories, just shy of an hour each. And all of season one was a story that I knew, and I was the one that suggested, I was like, hey, this is a thing I like a lot, and I have a lot of thoughts about. Season two, I knew the space I wanted to play in. I knew some of the anthology, but some of them were brand new stories, and we learned some lessons about, like, how important it is that before I even try to go through a script... that I know the story as well as I knew the Operation Mincemeat story, and I think season three will be better in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was a test to kind of expand the idea of what the show could be. We didn't want to get locked into telling one massive story every season. We wanted the ability to tell shorter stories. And
we also didn't want to get locked into being a history podcast.
Well, it's specifically a World War II history podcast, right? I think on some level we'll always be a history podcast in terms of like the stuff has happened in the past. But we didn't want to get locked into that specific war history or anything like that. And so this was, I think also it furthered the DNA. I think the secret DNA of the show is that it's World's Greatest Cons. And yes, every once in a while we're going to tell a story about what you think of as a con artist. But what we're trying to find are the very interesting stories that are maybe outside of somebody robbed somebody for money. And we, you know, being in the world of game shows gave us that ability, and a lot of the ideas we have going forward are similar.
And also keeps us true to the kind of stated subtitle of exploring history's history's greatest deceptions, you know, and where and when that is, whether it's a big tale or a small tale. Like episode 5 that came out last night is, and it's the first time we've done this, we didn't try to even pitch that this was the world's greatest con. We say, it's a genuine whodunit mystery on this, our season finale of World's Greatest Con.
Yeah.
Like, which is in the name of the show. Also, in the chat, Princess Delirium says something very nice. Brian sounded more confident in the telling of stories in season 2, more comfortable in the format, maybe. I think there's some of that. You know, we didn't know that there were these kind of rhythmic, you know, ballyhoos of the world's greatest con. You know, that all evolved naturally during season 1, but now we have those and we sort of can feel the lyricism.
The rhythm. Yeah.
Nice.
That's great. I'm so proud of you guys, what you've done with that.
I will say we're not done. Although season 2 is formally kind of at least the produced episodes are done, we still have a Q&A episode, and we have another fun treat coming. I won't say an episode, but there is a fun treat coming for folks who, especially who enjoyed the first season, in a few weeks. So
is it another Captain Morgan?
we just dropped the same thing. Nah. Like, could you imagine? People are like, "What is this?"
Just stop it! Stop it!
Stole my boat.
It's a really funny thing that we will have for people, but by and large, the reaction to this season has been out of this world. Especially everybody who joined the Patreon, it was great. When we were in Vegas, we talked to Teller and to hear from him to hear how much he loved season 1 was you know, there are a few ways that when you create stuff, I mean, whenever you create stuff, and especially if it breaks into a wider audience, you're going to get people that it just isn't for. They accidentally walked into a place that they thought was barbecue and it turned out to be serving tacos. And they're just going to be like, this isn't barbecue. One star. But it helps a lot when Teller is complimenting your stuff and you're like, you're not Teller. Opinion invalidated. One star review. Teller liked it. Answer that one, atheist.
Do you checkmate?
Checkmate.
Do you feel like user feedback was there any pieces of user feedback that shaped season 2?
No.
Still kept Brian, Bryce. So. Yeah.
that was the number one complaint. Actually, it is literally the number one complaint is like, narrator is pouring it on a little thick talking about his own stories.
Well,
jeez.
But again, number one complaint means of the 10 complaints.
Yeah, exactly.
Four of them.
Well,
autobiography was a little self-serving.
Again, and that's the thing is like with any kind of negative feedback, what I have learned through this process more than ever is like, if the negative feedback is accurately describing things you very much tried to do
on purpose,
that's fine. You want that. Cause again, they're walking in, They wanted more of a Wikipedia dump of things. They didn't want it. But our point, the reason why Brian is on the album art is that this is Brian Brushwood's interpretation of these events. So if you're like, I don't know, a little too much Brian for me, then that's fine. You wanted tacos. You walked into the barbecue stand. That's okay. I would be better if you didn't leave a one-star review, but that's fine. You have your ability to do that. The one thing that I will say is that certainly whenever you're telling one story over four episodes, I think that we justified it excellently in season one. I don't look back on it and say that it was too stretched out, but some people were like, hey, you probably could have told this in like, stuff you should know, told it in one episode. And it's like, that's fine. They did. That's great for them. We did it in four. But I think that there was an element of doing the anthology that we're like, hey, we can do one episode stories as well. And,
right.
And I think we wanted, so if there was a reaction to anything, that might have been it, to just demonstrate that wasn't, our point was never, we're going to stretch out every story. Our point is we're going to tell these stories in the space that we believe they deserve. And Fooling Hitler deserves four episodes. These stories deserve one.
Well, and also
they're smaller.
In the case of the Fooling Hitler story, there were also four important fundamental lessons of deception that needed to be taught along the way.
You know,
from the genesis of the idea to, you know, like you can't fool, you can't con a system, you can con a man, you know, and the reality of what it's like to take a hypothetical idea and make it truly visceral. And then that moment, the moment of surrender and so on. I think those were important chapters, and I'm pleased that we did it for that. I don't think that the stories we told in season two needed that. I don't think that there were four lessons in each of those stories. I think there was one or two good lessons in there, in each one.
Yeah, yeah. I think.
And back to your earlier point, too, that you, when you create stuff and you're trying to look at the world of feedback, is sometimes you want notes to know, like, is this for my audience? Is my audience liking it? But your example of, you know, going to getting tacos instead of barbecue, like, that's a problem that, you know, as a writer, you realize there's a disconnect between how this book presented itself and how this person understood it.
Yeah.
And then how they reviewed it. And it's like, I mean, like, should I spend all my day writing reviews of Disney XD television shows, you know, like,
you should specifically, I wonder.
Yeah. Aside from I wonder. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, go take apart. Like, I'm going to go write my review of the Twilight series. I'm going to take this. It's not my thing. And if it's something that's in my alley, it's something I follow it and whatever, then I'd be like, oh, this is where I felt this, whatever. And so you always have to weigh that as a creator and go, is this somebody who got the wrong thing? Did I do something wrong and presented it to them? And that's the danger of sometimes like, I just want to promote, like, never promote a book or a creative thing under false pretenses.
Yeah.
If you're dependent upon the reviews, because you that's where you pay the price. Having a teller, having somebody like that come out and signal out and saying you're doing this quality can mean a lot, because sometimes you put an effort that is invisible to most people. They do not see it. They don't see the real effort for this. They just hear words and say, I liked them. I didn't. And that sometimes you have, getting praise from a peer can mean a lot, or somebody you look up to can mean a lot, because you know that they see things, that they appreciate the little details that you put a lot of effort into. And often you don't get enough credit in creators for that. It's like, you know, like I spent 5 days figuring out this two paragraphs to explain this thing as succinctly as I can. So I get that dramatic element somewhere else. And like, I don't want people to notice that. But a really creative writer might notice that, and who I respect, and that means something to me. And that helps a lot. And I have an expression, which is like, if the monkeys at the zoo howl at you, does it make you angry? And we use that kind of like, when you should not be fazed by criticism or stuff like this. And people often like, somebody said something, like, cool. Like, in your head, you have to figure out who is worthy of getting you upset and not. And the answer can't be, oh, anybody who criticizes me. No, like there's a short list of people. If Justin or Brian called me up on the phone to say, hey, I think you crossed a line here somewhere, I'm going to listen.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to pay attention to that. And
likewise, I do think it merits at least a cursory examination of the comments that season two got, because if, let's say, an outsized number of them were saying, I think I fear this show is losing its way. What I liked about season one was this.
It was blank, blank,
and it's
blank.
Not
yeah.
this in here. Then that's useful feedback, so mm-hmm. you can course correct. But we did not get any of that. What we got was that guy talks about himself.
Well, and also a lot of those things, we don't know whether it's about season one or season two, right?
Right.
Like, especially on iTunes. But in general, what we were worried about with season two, which I think we can now say that it's all come out, is we were worried that it's like, what? Game shows? Give me another Hitler story. I thought this was the Hitler podcast. Brian cries and Hitler gets beat. That's your brand. And it's like we were worried that was what some of the reaction was going to be, and people would view it as too low stakes. And that's kind of why we gave such comfort food of game shows, because it's like, who doesn't love games? Who doesn't have a fond memory of watching game shows? And so thankfully we didn't get any of that, which I was thrilled about, because Brian pointed out, if we can do Hitler Gets Beat and the perfect bid on Price is Right, the galaxy within those two poles is enough for us to go a million seasons.
That's a big, what you get away with is often fascinating. Cause like it's sort of analogous, but when I was back in the day pitching TV shows and stuff, and I'd get into these arguments with producers and be like, no, people won't believe that. They won't believe it. I'm like, it all comes down to the credibility of how it's shot and the performer. I said, that's really what it comes down to. And I said, I'm going to show you a clip and you're going to ask me the completely wrong question after this, germane to what we're talking about. And then I would show them Darren Brown's Zombie Arcade.
Yeah.
And people afterwards, they go, was that ethical? Was that ethical? That ethical? I'm like, nobody's asking, was that real?
Yeah.
And I said, that's the thing. If I pitch this to you, what if I hypnotize people in arcade and make them really think they're fighting off zombies and they're confused by this? You'd be like, that's the stupidest thing in the world. Nobody ever do it, blah, blah, blah. But because it was convincingly done and Darren Brown has charisma and believability at the end of it, you're asking, was this ethical? Not, was this real?
Yeah.
And that's the thing where, you know, he won. That's why Darren Brown was so successful, was because you bought all of that. It was so constructive for the thinking person, the person with the slightly higher IQ, to go, whoop, oh, I don't know how it's done. And, you know,
well, and also you like any classic misdirection, or as I like to think of it, just direction, you introduce a shinier, better object. And, you know, we were talking about Our Flag Means Death. The comedy is so good. That's the shiniest thing. And there are other things that other people want to talk about, but I'm like, I'm still on how funny this show is. And I think you're 100% right.
And yeah, likable people and funny stakes is just, if you like the characters, it'll go a long way. And to the topic of, you know, Justin, when you talk about, like, at the end of it's just words and you don't know what to think of a thing because you've just seen it through so many iterations. I'll bring up one analogy too. Was like season one of The Witcher, the biggest criticism was the time jumps, right? Season two, they didn't do that. And they even made a joke about it. And I really enjoyed season two of The Witcher, thoroughly enjoyed it. But the fact that the producers kind of put a sly joke in there tells you they probably had a big debate during season one. Should we do this? Should we not do this? Unlike Game of Thrones, the last season, where I don't think there was a lot of debate about a lot of stuff. I think they just did stuff and they got criticized and they got, you know, it would hurt. They took it personally because they weren't really, they didn't have a better, like for season one, like I'm sure there was a debate, like, should we do this? And like, yeah, hey guys, remember that debate? We were wrong, but they loved it anyways. Let's go do season two and we'll take that note and work from there. Be helpful. So. I don't know. I never know when I finish a thing. I never know if my thing is good. And even after people tell me it's good or not, I still don't know. And I just had that I did my third Sloan McPherson story, Sea Storm, which comes out tomorrow, by the way. And I still don't know what the audience is.
Where can we pre-order it right now?
Amazon, yeah. Just go to Amazon, Andrew Main or Sea Storm or something. Yep. And again, not to say, well, this is the final, you know, deciding, but like, it was selected Publishers Weekly. It was a starred review. And mm-hmm. Publishers Weekly made it a pick of the week last week. And that's one of these things where you go, okay, well, I know it can't be garbage because there are hundreds and hundreds of books that came out last week.
Yeah. And yours was starred. I will say the one thing that I have found that I like the most producing as opposed to being kind of talent and producer is that I can focus mostly on, am I doing Brian justice as opposed to, is this good? Right. And I think sometimes when you, like for you, Andrew, you're coming up with the ideas, you're laying out the outline, you are filling it in. You are also your first editor to see whether or not this is good. So by the time that it gets to somebody else, they have a very different role, which is like, I think from my relationship to World's Greatest Con, I'm helping with the idea, like from the very beginning, I'm like trying to just put Brian in positions where not only is he good during production, but he is in a creative place where he is adding the Brianisms that need to be added. So it will always be authentically Brian. And then in the edit, it is like, how do we put that on the grandest scale so Brian is as smart and funny and charming as he could possibly be? And so I just know that if I'm following that North Star, then it can't be bad unless I listen to it and it's bad. And then I'm like, we need to totally change it. But like, but that's always the goal I'm trying to serve, as opposed to like, is this the greatest, is this the best podcast ever? It's like, no, is Brian a star? If Brian's a star, then I've done my job.
Well, problem solved. But I would say that's a very good point, because when you do a lot of things and you have skills in a lot of areas, you've got a great voice, Justin. You're very likable. You're a very good broadcaster. And so when you sit down to work on a thing that you did, your focus is going to be worried about your performance.
Yeah.
And you're not going to be as objective about that as you would be about somebody else. And that is an advantage of being able to sort of shut down some of those skills, so to speak.
Yes.
Or to say like, oh, I can dial back what I need from there. And I can give that person clearer direction than I could give myself. And so I think that's I'm very good at like, I can't read somebody's book and tell them it's good or not, because I really got horrible taste. But I can tell somebody, if they tell me a plot, I can tell you, well, I can break down a plot and tell you like where your acts need to be and stuff like that. I think that's my strength. My own stuff, I'm going to suffer and I'm going to be like, I don't know. I'll go through that indecisiveness. But I think I'm very good at like plot structure.
In the spirit of After Things content, Cliff Singer in the chat mentions that they supported the Patreon early on and don't feel conned at all. Good quality storytelling, worth it.
Sucker.
This was a genuine surprise, I think, to both of us. We tried something that we've never tried before, which is after producing the first season, we made no specific promise whatsoever of any benefit outside of, if you liked this and you want more, become a patron. We will only promise you more episodes that come out faster of higher quality, and you will never hear an ad.
Yeah.
And then it's on the one hand, it was terrifying for us month after month after month to send out one update. We're working on it. and fully expect like the pitchforks to come out and all this stuff. And they never did. And it was really like that patronage made a fundamental difference in our ability to hire talent,
yes,
in our ability to negotiate with confidence when it comes to the ad stuff and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We have had a playbook with Patreon since Patreon existed, and we violated all of our rules of Patreon. And learned a very powerful lesson about why some people do Patreon at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like, I'm kind of double down too. Like, if tomorrow I said, I'll give you an even better example, but I'll just say, if tomorrow I said, hey, everybody, I have a great idea for a science fiction movie. I need to make this thing happen. I need to raise $10 million. It's going to be a painful experience. If Christopher Nolan said that tomorrow, a guy with a track record who's delivered stuff and given stuff to us without ever having to ask for it, but just being presented to us, I don't think he'd have a problem. And the way you did it though, like you put this thing out there first, here's the thing we did. We put in all of this effort. We went through all this effort when nobody was paying us.
Yeah. Right.
You know, instead of the problem, we get that contract. People are like, well, if people pay me to do this, I'll do it.
Yeah.
I'm like, how do I know you'll do it? If you're not driven, you're purely told me there's a financial thing, which also tells me that if you do this, somebody else comes along to offer you more money for your, you're literally telling you there's a price for your time to change what you're doing right now.
Yeah.
And all I know is if I start contributing this and now you get a regular job and you're going to apologize, like, oh, that's great, but this thing took off for me. Now I got to do this. I hope you understand. This has been a great, and like, you guys don't have that problem.
It's funny when you mentioned the $10 million figure, I thought you were teeing up. Recently, Brandon Sanderson, a fan.
Came to my head right as I said it. Amazing. Talk about that.
Right. So Brandon Sanderson has written several epic fantasy books. He took over the Wheel of Time series to bring it to a close. He's got the Mistborn series. He's got whatever I'm reading now. Writes a lot. Like proven track
big,
record.
Big writer.
Right. He basically said, I have 4 books. I'd like to release them. Would you like to give me money? $10 million.
Boom.
Biggest raise ever. It's truly remarkable. And like, he is releasing like, here's an outline. Here's an element. Sorry, $33 million. Did
on
I
Kickstarter.
Say 10?
This is crowdfunding, by the way.
It wasn't 10 million. It wasn't 10 million. Okay, sorry. Let's not. 33 million.
$33 million.
On Kickstarter.
Wait, is it done?
Deal.
Is it done now, or is it still going?
That's what this article says.
He already had the books written. He had a sterling reputation among his fan base as hard workers.
Oh, sorry, 35. 35. Sorry, 35 million. And by the way, entering into its most profitable phase of any Kickstarter, the final 48 hours.
That's amazing.
So it will be more than 35 by the time that ends.
And, you know.
And I believe the books are already written. He wrote them during the pandemic.
Love it. Love it. And, you know, it's so funny to watch, you know, and Andrew, we've talked about this so much, but. You know, at the dawn of the internet, people understood that art was going to change. The way that money came into art had to fundamentally change as the internet was there. And all, especially in fiction, all the different ways people tried Stephen King's like, hey, pay me money or I stop writing these emails where the stories like keep coming. And then they stopped and he got pissed and he was like, not enough money.
Let me clear. Okay, Stephen King wrote The Plant, and the goal was it would just be free. And the moment that more people were getting the free version than paying for it, was he was going to stop. And you're like, okay, I as a person paying for this am now going to be punished because these other freeloaders came on board and heard about this?
Yeah.
It was the most perverse sort of thing in the world of like, it's that... And we talk about agency and theory of mind. And one of these big problems you hear people talk, they talk about the they.
Yeah.
They do this. Who is they? And here it's like, Steven, it's not like we all got together while you're out of the room. And I said to freeloaders, like, I paid, but you guys come on board and get it for free. And then I was in the middle of like 3 installments into The Plant and it stopped because what did I do wrong? Nothing. Humanity betrayed him. You see,
yeah.
That was the problem.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm still bitter. I love Stephen King, but I'm still bitter about I paid for the 3 installments of the Evan Plant, and then he cut it off because other people wanted it for free.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's so out of character for him to have an anticlimactic ending.
to alienate half of the people in the middle.
So anyway, Brandon Sanderson, is a testament to what happens when you build a lot of trust with your audience, and it's neat because like. My daughter's the one that got me hooked on his stuff. And she's like, do you want to know what it's about? And I'm like, I don't, I'm just happy he's making money and I want to support that. And she's like, hey, just so you know, read the outline. I'm into what he's doing. And there's, from what I've heard, these books, book 3 is going to be the one that's going to be your favorite. Like she's really into the iterative process of everything. But, sorry, we stepped on your line earlier, Bryce.
I am so glad. That was one of the things I wanted to get into it. I'm actually going to try to back his thing. Because like, he is consistently good. He is a guy that knows how to write to his audience. He can write different styles. He does fantasy. He does sci-fi. He's, you know, he's our age. He's a reliable, consistent guy. And when I saw what he did, it made me feel good about what the role of it means to be a writer in this world. It made me feel very good to know that if you are in there, I know people, writers who go like, ah, oh, it's like, Brandon is very, Brandon, we're buddies now, very disciplined as a writer, and he understands his business, and he understands his audience. And I'm saying, like if he can, if this guy at 45 or 46, whatever, can do a $33 million Kickstarter for three books.
35.
Somebody,
and counting, and counting.
440, 35,446,000 or 60,000. But anyway, if he can do this, I would imagine that somebody who is talented and puts the work into talent, who puts together their own effort, might be able to make a living as a writer.
To loop things back to World's Greatest Con, knowing that this is going to be a very long-term project, at some point I said out loud the words, I'm only interested in starting things that are only going to get better as I get older. And World's Greatest Con is one of those projects. You know, I'm sure it'll iterate and change or whatever, but man, do I look forward to 5 years, 7 years, 8 years from now when there's a hardcore history-esque back catalog of stories that we've collected. I can't wait to just keep providing value.
And when the Liar Man debuts.
The Liar Man. Yeah, we ain't heard from Matthew.
Liar Man. Where's Matthew? Where's Matthew McFadyen at?
McFadyen.
Or, I don't know, whatever. We'll figure it out.
He was lying about it.
We don't know. We left both pronunciations in the show because we don't legit know how his name is pronounced. It's pronounced too many ways on the internet. So that was a conceit of episode 4 where we realized that was an iterative. That was the hardest one to come together. But, in that episode is about the least well-known story of all of everything that we cover in season 2, but it's a great story. It's a really fun story. And at a certain point we figured out, oh, okay, it should be a movie pitch because this is the unproduced story. It's the unknown story. What if we're pitching this as a movie? Only to realize that, Matthew McFadyen from Tom from Succession, has been in a Netflix movie about Mincemeat, which is our first season. He has been in an ITV AMC series about the millionaire scandal, which was covered in season 2. And so the next episode, right after the millionaire one, is Brian pitching, like, hey, you've already done 2 of our episodes. You got to complete the World's Greatest Con trilogy. And making it a personal, direct movie pitch was kind of what unlocked that episode, which I thought was fun.
Which totally fixed the... The biggest problem with that story was just it was a little bit thinner than some of the other stories. And all of a sudden, it gave us creative license to fill in the gaps with comedic beats and specific names and highly visual imagery and so on.
Yeah. But it's a great simple
story. I want to go back to the Sanderson thing just for a second. I just want to make a point here. Sure. Nobody look at the Kickstarter page. Nobody, like, I'm going to ask you questions.
Yeah.
33 million. How many backers 25. Do you think there were?
Oh shoot!
Hard to see without knowing what the tiers are. But I'm going to take a wild guess. God, I'm not good at math.
150,000 pledgers.
I'll say 200.
Why did you do it, Bryce? He just gave me an answer.
Is that right?
Did he guess?
I'm guessing. This is a game.
Wait, how did he get the exact right answer?
The perfect bid.
Yeah. I'm still a Matthew
world's
Canadian.
Greatest con.
The fix is in, everybody.
You know a producer.
Oh, my God.
You work with him for years. Then one day, he ruins your show.
One day, he was asking me how many backers there were, and I really did guess.
That's amazing. I literally thought you were looking at the. I'm like, Bryce! I'm yelling at him, like, Why are you ruining it? I wanted to show how wrong they were.
Oh,
that's
my
awesome.
God.
But also that speaks to how much people are pledging before we even, we don't know how much it costs just looking at the page here, but that is what, like $300 per person, a little less than that, $200, $300 per person?
Yeah, well, I mean, the high tier stuff tends to throw that off a little bit, so I bet you the entry level thing is certainly beyond or below that, but yeah.
$40 is the lowest level that gets you anything.
Wow.
Which is relatively high. Usually, I mean, $10 to $30 is...
No, but they're... But
multiple books, yeah.
Multiple books, yeah, right? It's three books or four books?
Five, I think.
Four. Quarterly books.
Four. Quarterly books, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, four books for $40. That's wait, a bargain, basically.
What a great microcosm of
books.
The actual Price is Right moment, it's, where it's like Andrew instantly thought that the fix was in.
Shifty Bryce. But again, that's four ebooks. Look at the print to get the hardcovers.
Let's see here. The premium hardcover. Is that right? Yes. A premium hardcover quarterly books, $160.
Yeah, $40 bucks a pop. Yeah,
plus shipping.
Plus shipping. Yeah.
And that. So, go ahead.
Let's say so. What's very smart about this is he's extremely realistic. He is very realistic in what he offered. He also didn't decide I need to discount the ebooks on this, as he made the ebooks the same as if you were going to pay on Amazon. And that's part of the genius he's like, I think my fans are okay paying the. Instead of, I'll charge the same price for Amazon, and my fans will probably appreciate the fact that they get to buy it from me. And what it's that, or it's other than the opposite of like, what if you could sell yourself? I could make it cheaper. Or you could just make it the same, and people might actually feel good that you're getting all of the money.
Yeah.
Instead of them looking at like, you should give me $6 back, Mr. Sanderson. Like, oh, you get the extra $6, then I feel better now.
And like, look at this. So I'm looking at the different pledge levels here. The number one reward tier is that $160 premium hardcover books. 40,000 people have picked that. And then the next most popular one is the ebook at 36,000, and then the audiobook at 33,000. But
ooh, ebook and audiobook, almost the same. That's interesting.
And then on top of that, there's a $220 level that has all three of those. About 9,000 people have got that. So it's like there are high ticket items here, and I completely missed this. 20,000 people pledged $500 for all of those three different versions of the book and swag boxes. So he's got like I guess a merch element to it too.
But that's smart, is doing that at 500.
Right.
Yeah.
500, you don't mind packing those merch boxes or paying somebody to pack those merch boxes.
Also, I noticed that we haven't gotten to the one he actually has to sit down and sign his name a million times yet.
I don't think...
He didn't do a signature?
It might be an add-on.
God, I love him even more that he just didn't do any of the dumb S-word that normally happens with Kickstarter. I love it. I'm not signing anything. I'm not signing. I wouldn't sign my name if it was a contract that you gave me $10,000. Like you are just going to get books. That's why you're here. That's it. You want to come to a reading? I'll sign your book. Other than that, sorry. Here's books, baby.
Yeah, every chance it says hardcovers, it says in all caps, unsigned. On
love it.
Even better.
I'm buying the $500 one now. I am in love with Brandon Sanderson. Just get that money, King. You know it. You deserve it. $35 million. Knowing the economics of Kickstarter, I would not be shocked if it gets over 40. In fact, I would not be shocked if it gets, you know, even closer to
40 million.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, because now is when there's all of the impetus to go and do it before you miss out on it. And you won't be able to get it until later. He controls the entire release window. Just brilliant.
He's got the stuff is written. He's not promising to deliver until next year. It is such a. I'm just.
Oh, because it's going to be quarterly, so he will do it beginning next year.
Yeah.
So all the little hiccups you have to worry about, delivery, everything else like that, his fans know what they're actually, he's not going to, in theory, he's not going to have to.
You want to know what else is brilliant about this? Is he's going to literally be able to spend every penny of the production and probably even the shipping and warehousing of this before the end of the year, which for tax purposes, trust me, as somebody who has gotten caught on the other end of this, the tax implications of not having all of your business settled by the end of the year on Kickstarter money is very annoying.
Yeah.
So, oh, geez, Brandon, you're the best. You're the best.
Someone who clearly has this amount of cash and good reputation went with Kickstarter. They didn't roll their own thing. They didn't go to Indiegogo. They didn't do a fig investment crowdfunding. Like, it went on Kickstarter.
It's still a brand. That, it's such a brand.
Well, and you know, that's in spite of how much that they take in processing fees, how long it takes to turn that money around. I mean, it's not the most economical decision on paper. And so it reads as acknowledging exactly where, you know, the right platform at the right time.
Without getting into things that I probably should not be talking about on a public forum, Kickstarter is extraordinarily valuable. What you get from that, what you pay for when they do take more than Indiegogo and they take more than if you just ran a PayPal thing, is the brand. Mm-hmm. There is such, I mean, why is Patreon
the
valuable? The brand.
You show up on the front page and in their emails and all that stuff.
Yeah, that's beyond, the ecosystem,
yeah. Yeah, but beyond even their promotion, which is great. It's great when you get it. It does make a big difference if you get that promotion. It is a place where people trust spending money. It's where they probably already have their credit cards logged into their account because they bought, you know, Cards Against Humanity or Exploding Kittens or any of the other gigantic ones that have all made a jillion dollars. You benefit from them already having been in that ecosystem, and you are just eliminating barriers for people to spend money on you. I have made business decisions based on our ability or inability to be on that platform. I believe it is extraordinarily valuable.
Hmm. I agree. And like I said, too, is that ecosystem, it's so, all of my books are on Amazon. And I get people like, why are you using exclusively Amazon? I'm like, it's Kindle Digital Unlimited, the KDU platform. It's a monster. It is the terms of the deal are, I'm only going to be there. But when it works in your favor, boy, does it work in your favor. And it's worked wonderfully for me. And with Kickstarter, like, yeah, Sanderson doing this instead of some other platform, smart. I root for other platforms succeed, but like that boost, like if you come out with an iTunes, like an iPhone game, your goal is to have Apple select you. That's really the only way you're going to kind of get the attention you want is Apple selects you. You know, have the algorithm like you. And the same with other systems. And Kickstarter, you know, my friends did their $4 million puzzle on Kickstarter, and they got the love from Kickstarter because, one, they work with, well, the creators of Cards Against Humanity and Exploding Kittens.
Yep.
But also it was novel and different, and it was a different sort of pitch than what Kickstarter usually gets. And that's a big deal. It's a very, very big deal. Brandon Sanderson coming in, who is a huge writer who gets $1 million paydays, saying, I'm going to go use this platform. It benefits both. And I just, like I said before, like the takeaway for writers and creatives out there is, yeah, maybe there's not a $33 million, 35, whatever, 40 million. I'm going to call it 50 million right now.
Let's go. Fitty.
50 for everybody out there. But this was not a fluke. This was hard work writing. Yeah. Oh, well, if you get to finish the Wheel of yes, true. Everybody's going to have their own success story. But the hard work, the consistency as a writer and building up an audience, people had to like him. And if the average, I just paid 300 books and I've never finished one of his books. I've just paid $300. I've never finished one of his books, but I love what he's doing. And I'm like, I want to encourage that. And there's a lot of other people out there I'd love to root for if they did something like that,
mm-hmm.
but they're not.
Mm. Yep. Go off, King. That's our review.
Vinyl copies of World's Greatest God coming for $100,000 a pop.
We can get that out of your mom.
But, but look at the music industry, right?
No.
With vinyl, even CDs, like they are losing their functionality and are becoming much more valuable as mementos and keepsakes. And you have to imagine that is exactly what's going on here. Part of his campaign is, I'm going to have 4 books, all of which you can get in physical copies, and I'm going to make a bunch of boxes of stuff about the universe.
I bet you a thing that could sell right now. Like if you work, Brian, if you ever wanted to do your motivational book or something along those lines, if you got motivated to do it, you could see what I did there?
Yes.
They used to have these, they fell out of fashion, but like they were like literally like those, they're like the portable MP3 players you could plug a headphone into.
Oh, like play buttons.
If somebody sold like, hey, I'll give you the digital copy player, but I'm also going to give you the credit card MP3 player and the headsets for $50 extra and they cost you $3 in Alibaba. That would be such a neat thing for things because we want to fetishize certain things. And that's the thing I think about, like, oh, if there was a, like you look at what Kanye is doing with his
Kanye and the stem player.
Yep. So there's something neat about the idea of like, I've created it's a simple device, but this thing represents the thing that like we're buying hard copies of books. It's like, yeah, for $3, I'm like, I'm going to give you the audiobook on this card with headphones plugged into it.
I'm 100% down. I actually really wanted to do vinyl copies, but the wait time, because that industry is ramping up, it's like 6 to 8 months. It's ridiculous.
The problem vinyl for you is that vinyl is great for selling to people who collect vinyl and have record players. To an audience that's not used to buying vinyl.
Correct.
It's a cool thing to put on the wall.
Yeah, we're also a hard thing format wise, because even when we were thinking about doing it for the Night Attack albums, which were at least albums, it was just way too long. We would have had to cut a bunch of stuff, and like we would have had to cut parts of the show, which it's like, if you're the completionist that wants to buy a vinyl thing, then unfortunately that format was a hard fit for us. But I still do think that there's stuff that we could do, and that's the beauty about brands like with World's Greatest Con. If all of a sudden we wanted to do another thing, or if we had finished this is what I love about this Brandon Sanderson thing, and I only tangentially was aware of him before this, but it's like if we just took the time and just secretly did a thing and then said, hey, here's a 50 episode series that you're just gonna get, it's already done, give me money right now. And I'll send you swag or transcripts or whatever, unsigned. I'm uploading something to make it happen.
It's going to be unsigned by Brian Brushwood. It's going to be unsigned by Justin Robert Young.
Unsigned.
It's going to be unsigned by Bryce Castillo. You're going to love
now,
it.
I will not be unsigning yet. I don't want my name not associated with this.
What a God king, this man. I love him.
We've said this before, but it's worth reiterating, is the already done.
Yes.
Those are the magic words, already done, mm-hmm. already done, because people have been betrayed and misled. And I've had friends who I've supported that is on Kickstarters and Patreons that I never got the thing because they did it out of desperation and then their problem resolved itself. Their need to, they didn't realize the price. They didn't realize that like, great, people just invested a bunch of capital in you, not just really the money for the thing, but trust in you. And now that you didn't finish the thing, that your reputation's now kind of gone and they don't appreciate that. You know, it's like, I got this thing, it's hard. I'm like, your justification works great. And people aren't necessarily going to write you angry letters, but it's going to be like, yeah, you're a flake.
Yeah. All right. I think we're over on time. So my pick is World's Greatest Con and Brandon Sanderson.
My pick is Teller's Twitter account at Mr. Teller.
Those are all my picks too.
My pick is season 3 of World's Greatest Con. Yeah. Brandon Sanderson's scheme for Kickstarter.
You sure you weren't supposed to?
Unsigned.
It turns out he's like, the answer is Comic-Con 1999.
Yeah.
That was the world's greatest con.
there has got to be, he's got to have some success story. There's got to be something of Brandon being going from, going from con to con to push his books and stuff and trying to get gas money or hoping you sell enough books at the table. Or that's the story I want to hear.
35.
I was a millionaire at 15 because of my investments and I wrote for fun on a beach with supermodels. All right. Cool.
How do you really feel?
What's your third act reveal? That's a supermodel on the beach.
Gentlemen, it's been after.
Hells yeah.
She was Eastern European.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.